Good morning, Santa Fe, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We are streaming on the web at ksfr.org, and this show is podcasting on the internet at santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show any time of day thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can also subscribe to the show at iTunes. I'd like now to welcome by telephone Paul Muller Ortega. He is professor of religion at the University of Rochester. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Good morning.
It's great to have you.
Thank you.
I've been looking at some of the books you've written, and I've been thinking about the how people approach spiritual practice, and you can approach religion and spiritual practices of India as a scholar of scripture and as a practicing meditator. How do these two approaches complement each other, for both for the traditional Indian spiritual teacher and for you as an academic living here in this culture?
Well, speaking for myself, it's been a very kind of synergistic path. I've been fascinated, I suppose my parents would say obsessed, with India from the time I was actually a child. And I wanted to study Sanskrit, and I was fascinated with yoga and yogis and teachers from India and so on, even as I was an adolescent. And so I have pursued, over the course of about 40-some-odd years, a kind of dual path, if you will. On the one hand, plunging very, very deeply into academic training, Sanskrit, the study of Indian religion, et cetera, and all of that fueled at the same time and supported and illuminated, one might say, by a parallel path in which I've studied from the time I was about 17, actually, with several very famous, actually, and very powerful Indian meditation teachers, and lived in their hermitages, their ashramas, and traveled to see them in India and various places in the United States and in Europe and so on, and evolved for myself a very deep practice, particularly of the form of yoga that involves meditation, the kind of interior journey. So these two things have complemented each other, and in some ways, you know, to go to the second part of your question, this is a very traditional mode, actually, in India, that scholarship is done in the context of a deep personal or experiential immersion, and it's supported and made kind of vibrant and alive by that kind of tasting of the very topic, if you will, that is being studied in the spiritual and traditions of Indian scholarship. That said, it hasn't really been such an easy combination to work out in the West. My academic colleagues and companions have sometimes been sort of dubious of my association with all of these crazy yogi types, and some of my wonderful companions in the yoga world have been a little surprised, I suppose, by my desire to spend weeks and months and years immersed in the translation of Sanskrit texts and the pursuit of that form of scholarship. But that's been me. So.
How interesting and almost baffling that American scholars who know very well that this is a sort of dual tradition of scholarship and practice would look askance on that.
Well, there's a long history in American religious studies scholarship and the history of religious scholarship that would lead to that, and it takes us a little far afield to get into it. It's not that they don't understand the fact that as a scholar one is personally fascinated. There's a whole tradition of sort of in anthropology, for example, of participant observer and so on, and certainly I think that actually many scholars of religion, if not all of them, begin, as it were, from a perspective of a personal fascination or a personal kind of inquiry or a personal set of experiences. But there is a tension between the two. Obviously, in the university classroom, one has to teach with a certain kind of dispassion and a certain kind of not so much detachment, but a kind of cool clarity that stands a little bit apart from the traditions and is teaching about history and about doctrine and about ritual and about theoretical matters, and that is not really transmitting, as it were, the content of the tradition, because that's not really appropriate in a certain way to do in a university classroom. And so that's part of it, I suppose.
We're talking to Paul Muller Ortega. Let's talk about the radiant heart of Shiva. What do we mean by radiant heart? Let's talk about the symbolism of the heart.
Yes. This is an ancient, beautiful, very exquisite term, Hridaya, in Sanskrit, which is found particularly in a series of texts that emerged from Kashmir in the northern Himalayan regions of India, starting at around the 6th century of the Common Era of our time, and in which great Siddha masters, great perfected masters of what's called Shaiva Yoga, discovered and elaborated this vision of the interior spaces of human consciousness as a kind of pulsating heart. They described it as a place of luminosity and of bliss and of enormous expansion, and and they said that every human being, and that indeed reality more widely, is pervaded and filled and inwardly supported by this spacious consciousness, which they call the heart. They don't really mean by the heart either the physical heart, or indeed in the sort of more technical versions of the so-called chakras in the esoteric yogic physiology, the heart chakra. Neither of those is what is meant. What is really meant is this notion of the deepest core essence of what a human being really is, and that that core essence at its basis is an unbounded, radiant, perfect consciousness that pulsates. And this is this term, spanda, in the Shaiva tradition, the tradition of theology and yogic practice that holds the Hindu god Shiva at its center. They talk about this notion of spanda, pulsation or vibration. They say that this ultimate pulsation of this consciousness, in fact, is the source that pulsates reality into being. These are very fascinating ideas in and of themselves, and of course, they're very fascinating also when one thinks of interesting kind of parallelisms in modern science with regard to sort of an ultimate void space that somehow out of which the material reality of this world all emerges. I'm not saying that the Shaiva sages and Siddhas were scientists, but there are curious parallelisms there. So this is this notion of the heart, the core, deepest essence. And the idea then in the Shaiva tradition is that one learns to live and discover and uncover that deepest place. It's a place of silence, but it's a vibrant silence that's alive. It's not dead, and it's not absolute in a sense of inertia. It's considered to be fully the deepest, most alive piece of us. And that from that space, in fact, all of the energies that support our mind and our perception and indeed even our physical body are kind of streaming out and radiating. They use these beautiful images of the so-called Shakti Chakra, the wheel of the powers of this great consciousness, the Shakti Chakra. And so they imagine that at the very center of our being, there's this pulsating, almost like a sun or even a moon, that radiates out these rays of consciousness, and that these then become the activities of our mind and indeed the sense capacities themselves and the capacity to perceive the external world. And that by tapping into this place, we can change the way that we think. We think about ourselves, how we experience ourselves, and we can also change our perception of the world. Ultimately, this is all a form of what comes to be called in the highest sense, what's called Tantra. Not the Tantra, perhaps, that we're so much more familiar with in the West and so on, but Tantra in the sense of the sort of esoteric highest teaching, the elaboration of the esoteric highest teaching of Indian spirituality. And this idea that by tapping into the heart, the perception of the world and the perception of oneself and the perception of others can really be infused with a kind of divine energy that transforms one's perception. One begins to see that the world is in fact sparkling and radiating with consciousness and with bliss and with ecstasy, in fact, and that's the goal of these traditions, to live from the heart and to allow the heart to support and infuse every moment and every day of one's existence.
Now, does consciousness, as you talk about radiant consciousness, rays of consciousness streaming out. Does consciousness exist above and apart from individual experience?
Yes. I mean, in the sense that that consciousness is exactly, in some level, what comes to be symbolized and mythologized in the Shaiva tradition as Shiva. That's what they're talking about, ultimately, this idea that there is a sort of autonomous and independent, as it were, reality of this absolute consciousness, which itself allows or permits, as it were, we can say initially, fragments of itself to differentiate and to begin to experience them. These fragments begin to experience themselves as individuated, and that's what indeed each of us as a human being is. We are sourced out of this, what comes to be called sometimes in a different metaphor, this ocean of consciousness, which arises in various individual waves. The waves think of themselves as separate, and yet indeed they are finally going to they arise from and subside back into this infinite, expansive, radiant ocean of consciousness. So there is individuation, there is separation, and there is the perception of individuality that each of us has, but the secret, as it were, of the tradition is that, in fact, each of us as an individual wave is, in fact, finally, at our deepest identity, this autonomous and absolute consciousness, and that the journey to the discovery of that as a real experiential realization, as something that becomes tangibly alive for one and is not just a kind of philosophical concept or a theological doctrine or teaching, is indeed the core of what this form of Indian spirituality is really about. It's a very long journey, but nevertheless, this is the journey, as it were, the journey back to that absolute consciousness. So there is separation, there is difference, but ultimately that difference is encompassed and re-embraced, as it were, by that totality.
Now, is that totality distinctly human, or is it a life force that infuses all living beings, human, animal, and everything else?
It's beyond human, and yet there is nothing in us that is not that as human beings, as it were, so that anything that we are has arisen as a manifestation of a potentiality that is contained within that absolute heart of Shiva, as it were, and yet at the same time, that consciousness is in fact the source of everything. It's not just, in the Indian tradition, they use this term Vishva, which means the cosmic totality, everything, the entire world, indeed all animals, all beings, all materiality is in fact somehow manifested or emitted, as it were, out of this consciousness. And they use sometimes a variety of different metaphors, one of which is this idea of the condensation or coagulation or crystallization of that consciousness. It's like water, which is vapor, which then becomes liquid, and then that liquid can be frozen, as it were. So the vapor is invisible, the liquid you can see, and it's movable in a certain kind of way, and then the frozen solid ice, which I'm surrounded by here in wonderful western New York State, at the University of Rochester, that ice is, as it were, the material forms of objects which we think are inert, but which in the in this vision of spirituality ultimately come to be recognized as nothing but that ultimate Shiva consciousness. There's a very famous saying in the Hindu tradition about this, na shivam vidyate kvachit, which means there is nothing but that Shiva consciousness altogether in the final assessment.
And so, what is the nature of the practice of meditation you're teaching? In other words, I suppose the goal for individuals is to experience that type of consciousness. How do you do that? What do you actually do in the practice?
Well, it's, of course, it takes a whole weekend to start to talk about this. But there's a sense in which, part of what's involved in a certain sense is the learning of the process by means of which your own consciousness, which in a certain sense is itself a kind of crystallization and a condensation and a thickening, if you will, of that ultimate absolute consciousness. How do you learn to allow yourself to melt, as it were? How do you allow your thickened and individual and separative consciousness to release its its sort of its superficiality and its thickening, as it were, into limitation, into the experience that we each have of being separate. And how do we allow that to begin? And it's understood in the Indian tradition that this is not something that's learned overnight, or even indeed in a weekend seminar or anything like that. But one makes a beginning, as it were, towards an interior process of allowing consciousness spontaneously, in a certain sense, and that's part of the secret, that there is a spontaneous mechanism, as it were, that's inbuilt into awareness, which, just as it allows us to manifest outwardly into the world, also, when properly aligned and learned, and there are many techniques, and there are whole, beautiful books from the Indian tradition. They're filled with hundreds of specific kinds of suggestive techniques that give one kind of angles of entry to activate, as it were, a kind of spontaneous process of going deeper and deeper and deeper inside of oneself. And so the journey of Shaiva Yoga is, in fact, the journey of understanding on one level with the mind the kind of theoretical support of practice, and then understanding, I call it the theory of the practice, and then the practice of the practice, as it were. What is the theory? What's involved in doing all of this, which gets much more technical, and so on. And then there's the actual practice of the practice, which is something, on some level, it's akin to kind of learning to ride a bicycle. It's like, at first, it seems very frustrating. You think, I'm never going to do it. And then when you actually get that sweet spot, as it were, of inner balance and inner poise and so on, it's a very sort of exhilarating discovery. And then it's a question of allowing that to open up over the course of perhaps many, many years of dedicated practice, such that bit by bit one begins to enhance and open that interior space of the heart.
Paul Muller Ortega is a professor of religion at the University of Rochester. Thank you so much for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much. It's wonderful to talk with you today.
I'd like now to welcome Maureen Fiedler. She's the host of Interfaith Voices, a radio program that airs on many stations across the United States and Canada, including on KSFR on Sunday mornings from 7 to 8. Welcome, Maureen Fiedler, to KSFR.
Well, thank you. It's delightful to be with you.
It's great to have you, too. Your program features a broad range of guests, people from many religions, many different topics. How did you start this whole program?
Well, actually, this started as I was driving from Washington, D.C. to Western New York. That is to say, it started in my head at that point. This was a time about 10 years ago when my parents were ill and they lived in that section of the country. And I would drive through these long stretches of rural Pennsylvania where the only programming I could ever hear of a religious nature, in fact, the only radio programming I could hear, was Christian Rite Broadcasting. And I found myself getting rather angry as I drove through because I heard a lot of negative remarks about other people's religions. I heard vilifying comments about Islam. I heard, anti-female statements and so forth. And I began to realize that there was a crying need for programming about faith traditions that was across the board, that was inclusive, and that tried to help people understand what different faith traditions taught and what they believed, and put some emphasis on the commonalities even when they're present. And so I started, I moved into being a commentator with National Public Radio and then later launched this show.
Now, the intersection of religion and politics is something you address in many different ways on the program.
Right.
And there's a close correlation between conservative and progressive churches and conservative and progressive political activities. Do you think that religion is inherently political?
Oh, that's a wonderful question. In some ways, yes, insofar as values inform politics, and values ought to inform politics. And so a conservative is going to want to express his or her values in the political order, and the same thing with progressive people. I think the problem begins to occur when that becomes an institutional imposition, or when my position becomes the one that I want to impose on everybody, whether they believe like I do or not, or whether I want to impose it without a general consensus in society about a particular viewpoint.
Do you see any correlation between theological positions and political opinions?
Yes, there certainly is some, at least within Christianity. That's true.
What would be some examples of that?
Well, probably one of the most obvious is that many people, but not all, who are theologically, let's say, opposed to abortion or gay marriage, tend to be on the more conservative end of the spectrum. On the other hand, people who are theologically opposed to war, like those of the Quaker tradition, for example, might tend to be more on the progressive end of the spectrum. On the other hand, there is, of course, historically in recent times, it's the right wing that has held the religion and politics portfolio in the public, if you will. But I think that's beginning to change, because even within the evangelical community, you're finding a shift in emphasis away from the more personalistic issues like abortion, gay marriage, etc., toward the social justice issues, such as what do we do about poverty, global warming, the environment, that sort of thing. And so I think we're going to see some changes coming around in that area.
I was thinking more of, like, real hardcore theology, like things like, I was wondering if the people who believe that God is everywhere and in everything are more liberal than people who believe that God is up there and in heaven, you know, and not within us.
Well, I think that those who believe that God is everywhere, as opposed to being up in heaven, that's sort of the distant God.
Right.
And people that believe in a distant God, and there was a study done on this out of Baylor University not long ago, people who believe in a distant God don't tend to apply very much of their theology to politics one way or the other.
Interesting.
Those who believe that God is more imminent, more part of our lives, trying to inform the value system that we bring to the larger community, I think those people are more likely from either end of the spectrum to bring their values into the political order.
We're talking to Maureen Fiedler, host of the radio program Interfaith Voices, that broadcasts on KSFR early, early Sunday morning from 7 to 8.
But I hear from an awful lot of listeners.
I know a lot.
You must have some early risers.
Well, we do indeed. It's incredible. It's a very popular program on KSFR. Right-wing spirituality has, as everybody knows and as you discovered in great detail on your trips through Pennsylvania, has been a dominant political force since the Reagan era, a great deal of influence of the religious right on politics. What about the role of progressive religion as a political force over the last couple of decades and right now?
Well, I think we need to remember progressive religion was a force in the 60s and 70s. Because Martin Luther King certainly represented that in the civil rights movement. And certainly some parts of the environmental movement were that as well. But then it waned in the 80s under the Reagan administration and certainly in the 90s. We're seeing a resurgence of it now, I think, began really in the 2004 election. And before that, we had the National Association, I think, right, the National Conference of Spiritual Progressives held an inaugurating conference here in Washington, D.C. Most of the Democratic candidates, even those looking ahead to 2008, have hired a religious advisor to try to figure out how to organize people who have those kinds of or religiously based concerns of whatever variety. And you find progressive religious people organizing. There's a group that has formed out of the Center for American Progress in Washington, D.C., called Faith in Public Life, which comes at these questions from a more progressive perspective. But I think you're also seeing the emergence in the popular consciousness of a lot of issues that are touching people's lives very intimately that are more inclined to bring out the progressive values. For example, the war in Iraq tends to bring out the values of peacemaking, negotiation, diplomacy, as opposed to violence. The realities of health care in this country and the fact that we have so many uninsured tend to bring out questions about poverty, social justice, that sort of stuff. And global warming is even leading to what they call a greening of the evangelicals. People like Richard Cizik, whom we've had on this show, who's vice president of the National Association of Evangelicals, are trying to bring that environmental message to the larger evangelical community, and may I say with some success.
You were recently at the anti-war march in Washington, D.C. What kind of faith-based groups did you speak with, and what were they saying?
Oh, my. They were all over the place. Certainly the Quakers were well represented. The Episcopal Peace Fellowship, the Buddhist Peace Fellowship had a rather sizable delegation. I ran into folks from the Hindu yogic tradition, Unitarians, all kinds of Roman Catholics, principally under the banner of Pax Christi, and so forth. Mainstream Protestants of all kinds, and the Jewish community as well, quite well represented. There was an interfaith service that morning at which, in fact, the principal homilist was Rabbi Michael Lerner, who gave a very challenging sermon calling on the community to inaugurate a foreign policy of generosity and love rather than a foreign policy of dominance and violence. So it was a very representative group. What I found most interesting, actually, was the small counter-demonstration that I ran into, which were folks that were supporting Bush's policy. And I went and, of course, asked them exactly the same question I asked everyone else, but the side comments were interesting. One man said to me when he realized what I was doing, he said, "Oh, you're interviewing people of faith? Did you find anybody at all over there?" And it was, and he said that with a certain wistfulness, but a certain level of seriousness, like if you were a person of faith, somehow you had to be supporting Bush. It was very interesting.
It's a huge sort of religious cultural divide when you hear things like that.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. It was also interesting to find out that the folks who were in support of the war policy had a more difficult time answering the question, what is it about your faith that brought you here? Because, well, in most cases, it wasn't their faith that brought them there. It was certainly their politics, and it isn't like your faith had to bring you to either part of the march, but they, except for one young evangelical woman who said that, well, I'm here because I support the president, and she owned that, in fact, she thought God had put Bush in the White House, and that she believed him, and she trusted him, and that's why she was there. And she was dead serious.
We're talking to Maureen Fiedler. In every religion that I know of, there is an admonition for peace. So where is the, I mean, how did, for example, the people who were there at that march justify war and justify lengthy war of aggression in theological terms?
Well, they didn't see it, of course, as a war of aggression, at least the people supporting the policy. One man who was a Roman Catholic said to me, well, Catholicism teaches me that I need to help other people out, and so I think that's what we're doing in Iraq, and that's how he saw it. As I said, the evangelical woman simply trusted Bush because God put him there. There wasn't an attempt to justify aggression. They simply didn't see it that way. They simply saw it as our helping somebody else.
There are, however, attempts to justify war through classical just war theory.
Yes, 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 yes. None of them put that forward. Actually, on either side did I hear much about just war theory. I think I actually think the tenets of just war theory are not generally well known among the laity of just about any denomination. I think people tend to emphasize violence, or they kind of have a gut reaction that you shouldn't attack someone, at least who hasn't attacked you, for example. gut feelings about preemptive war, for example, but and a feeling about civilian casualties. That definitely does come through, and you hear particularly anti-war people talking about the bloodshed, and then also the cost, the real cost in lives and in money.
Now, your program is called Interfaith Voices, and we mm-hmm. spoke just a moment ago about a cultural divide. To what extent is there a dialogue going on between conservative right religion and progressive religion?
That's a good question. I, except on our show, I don't think, occasionally, not a great deal. There's much more interfaith dialogue going on. But some of the places that bring this together are the places where progressive evangelicals are emerging. For example, you find somebody like a Tony Campolo or Jim Wallace from Sojourners. And those folks bring together some of the more traditional evangelical concerns, but with a very progressive social justice outlook. But I'm not aware that any of them are actually conducting dialogues on this. I would suspect, though, that the National Association of Evangelicals has internally an ongoing discussion, thanks to people like Richard Cizik, at least on selected issues like the environment.
So you did a program recently on a Buddhist approach to politics, which I think
That's
would probably
right.
interest a lot of people here in Santa Fe. What's that all about, given that Buddhism seems to be, on one level, more contemplative than active?
That was exactly the first question that I asked Melvin
right.
McLeod, who's a Canadian Buddhist and has written a book called Mindful Politics. And he said, well, what we have to do is simply take the Buddhist values of things like compassion and mindfulness and so forth and stretch them out, as he said, into the social order. And he said he felt Buddhism had been misinterpreted as kind of a quietist tradition, and it really isn't, although he owned that it's really Western Buddhism that made that more societal contribution to the Buddhist tradition. He also talked about the nonviolent emphasis within Buddhism and the fact that most Buddhists in the United States tend toward the progressive end of the political spectrum, although he owned that certainly one could be a conservative and a Buddhist at the same time, as are many Asian Buddhists. So it was quite a fascinating conversation, but it brings Buddhism well beyond, you know, the quiet monk that we see in the lotus position at prayer, if you will.
Right, right. Another interesting program that you did was about faith-based movements to cancel debt for poor nations. Tell
That's
us
right.
about that.
Yes, this is the Jubilee movement. And these are the movements that don't get the kind of coverage in the mainstream media that I think they deserve. And that's partly why we put them on. And it's a very serious movement, been going on since really the late 90s, when people of with biblical understanding realized that in the Judeo-Christian tradition, at least 2000 was a Jubilee year, a time when you're supposed to forgive debts in that tradition. And so they called for the forgiving of international debt because so many of the poorest nations of the world will never be able to pay back their debt. And the fact that they're trying to just mires poor people more deeply in poverty by the day. And so they began that movement. They've actually had quite a bit of success. But now 2007, a seventh year, is a Sabbath year, and also another time to forgive debts. And so they're renewing their efforts. And there's quite a coalition of groups at the grassroots level that are doing this.
And what's interesting is not only are they succeeding in getting debt canceled, but once the country is free to actually use their resources for their people, they've managed to do so.
Right, and they've made real progress. I remember my guest talked about Tanzania, which has put substantial resources into education, other countries that have put it into health care, and it's really making a difference at the grassroots level because finally they have the resources to do social change at the grassroots level.
We're talking to Maureen Fiedler. There's a great deal of material about religion on the internet, and there's even religious software with hypertexted Bibles that give vast amounts of historical interpretation. You did another show on that that was fascinating. How do you think the internet and the widespread use of computers are affecting the way people think about and practice religion?
Oh, I think they're having an enormous effect. I, of course, did an interview with Reverend Hong about computers and biblical studies. And what you can find very quickly, if you're a biblical literalist, is that there have been, for any given verse of the Bible, umpty-ump different interpretations of it and translations. And I'm actually about to do an interview with someone else who's quite well-known and provocative, Bart Ehrman, who's written a book called Misquoting Jesus. And he chronicles how various scribes of Scripture over the centuries actually changed the text when they copied it in some cases. But anyway, but to get back to the core of your question, computers can affect biblical studies. They also, you've got immense sources of religion news, beliefnet.com being a major place where people can go for internet news on religion. There are all kinds of religious blogs from both a progressive and conservative perspective. There are places like The Revealer. There's Faith in Public Life puts out the leading religion headlines of the day. And then there are even some people who basically go to church online or develop a faith community online with whom they communicate and even worship. So the internet has changed things enormously.
I mean, there's a certain leveling aspect to the internet, because information is readily available to everybody, at least everybody who has computer access, and not just to the ruling elite, whether it be doctors or lawyers or priests.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Anyone can have access to it. Anyone can easily research ideas that they might have, let's say on a biblical passage and its various interpretations. It doesn't cost them any money. They can simply do a search and try to find what they need. And it contributes, I think, to the increasing education of a well-informed laity in whatever faith tradition.
Now, what is your, if I may ask, own religious background? And what do you bring from that to the show?
Well, I'm a Roman Catholic. In fact, as some of your listeners might know, I actually am a Roman Catholic nun, a Sister of Loretto. And so that's the tradition that I know the best. But I've certainly tried to learn as much as I can about other faith traditions, because we live in the most religiously diverse country on the face of the earth. And I think that if we're going to promote peace, either domestically or internationally, if we're going to promote justice, if we're going to stop horrible tendencies like anti-Semitism, Islamophobia, etc., we have to learn what those other traditions teach and appreciate the many elements and commonalities that they share with the dominant religious traditions in this country.
Tell us more about the Sisters of Loretto. What kind of activities do you do? What is the nature of your practice?
Well, actually, there are a few of us in the Santa Fe, Albuquerque area.
We had one on the air recently who'd written a book about China.
Oh, yes, P.J. Mannion.
Yes.
Right, and the Sisters of Loretto in China. Well, we were founded, let me say, in 1812 on the Kentucky frontier, first religious community of women founded in the new country, the United States. And literally, we followed the Santa Fe Trail west, which is how we wound up in Santa Fe. And through most of the 19th century, we went and made major stops. That is to say, we still have a lot of people in the areas of St. Louis, Kansas City, Denver, down toward Albuquerque, Santa Fe, El Paso, Texas, and then on to California. But principally, the community has been involved in education at all levels, whether it's the elementary, secondary, or college level. And we have, I think it would be fair to say, in the contemporary age, because of the great leadership we have had in recent years, we have a very strong tradition of advocating for peace and social justice. It's an important thrust in the community, and now environmental sanity as well.
We're talking to Maureen Fiedler. What kind of response do you get from your radio listeners around the country and even beyond our borders, and how do these influence your shows?
Well, actually, we get a lot of different responses, a lot of email responses. Almost all of them are positive, to be perfectly honest with you. Now and then, somebody will make a suggestion for a topic for the show. We take all of those suggestions seriously. In fact, on our new website, we've put in a new feature called Pitch Us a Story, so that if someone has an idea for something or someone they think deserves coverage, we're going to take a look at it and consider it seriously. But we take comments very seriously from our listeners, but most appreciate what we do.
What do you think is, well, first of all, I wanted to ask you, what is the most unusual religion that you've ever featured on your program?
The most unusual religion? I hesitate to describe a religion as unusual, I guess, because it's usual to its practitioners.
Right, right.
We do cover, I think a better phrase, we do cover minority religions, ones that are not practiced very widely in the world. We have, for example, Baha'is are, that's a religion that's an outgrowth of Islam, actually, but a very progressive religion in the spectrum today. But Baha'is are persecuted in Iran, and so we certainly have had Baha'is on the show. We've had representatives of Haitian Vodou, of Santeria, of various traditions like that. When I'm in Santa Fe, in that area, I actually hope to interview some of the Native American practitioners of various spiritual traditions, because that's an area that I'd like to give more airtime to.
What do you think is the best way, or what are some of the best ways to foster religious tolerance?
I think there's no substitute for dialogue and for actually sitting down and getting to know someone of another faith tradition, inviting them to your home, having dinner with them, listening to the stories of their families, understanding that they're human beings just like the rest of us. And so, and let me say, an awful lot more of this is going on around the country than we hear about. Dr. Diana Eck at Harvard University, who runs the Pluralism Project and who studies this kind of thing, talks about the dialogues that are going on at the grassroots level and the times when many people of faith have actually come to defend the rights of those of another tradition. If I can just tell a brief story, one of the most moving ones for me happened right after 9/11, where two things happened. I had at that stage, I had a call-in show. This was about 4 days after 9/11. A very prominent rabbi came into the studio, David Saperstein. He and another rabbi had, within hours of that event, produced a petition saying, "Do not take this out on Muslims." They could see, as Jews who had been oppressed in the Jewish tradition, what could happen, and they didn't want it to happen to their Muslim brothers and sisters. I was stunned. And then in Denver, Colorado, the Interfaith Alliance organized again within, I think, about 2 weeks, about 2,000 people to go to a local mosque and join hands in a circle around it, again to say, we are not going to allow a vilification of our Muslim brothers and sisters because of what a couple of Muslims did in New York and Washington. So I think that there's a lot more of that understanding at the grassroots level than we hear about.
And then for that to filter up to the upper levels of politics is the trick, I guess.
It is. I do give President Bush credit for having said as much right after 9/11. If you remember, he visited a mosque, and I do think that was very helpful at the time. And however, it hasn't filtered up totally. We have the first Muslim member of Congress, of course, Keith Ellison of Minnesota, and we had some people raising questions about his taking his oath on the Quran, which blew me away. Why wouldn't you want someone to take an oath on the book they believe in,
right?
You know? But I thought Keith Ellison's response was fabulous when he decided, he found out somewhere, that Thomas Jefferson had had a copy of the Quran. And so he swore his oath of office on Thomas Jefferson's Quran, which I thought was a magnificent symbol of bringing together the finest of who we are as Americans with the finest of our interfaith traditions.
Amazing.
Amazing.
Well, Maureen Fiedler, it's unfortunately time for us to go. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Well, thank you, and I look forward to seeing Santa Fe once again. It's a beautiful place.
And the website for Interfaith Voices, which is Maureen Fiedler's radio program, is interfaithradio.org, and Interfaith Voices airs on KSFR on Sunday mornings at 7 a.m. from 7 to 8. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. Podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz.